This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, I'm Paul Jay. Welcome to the Analysis.News podcast. This episode is produced in collaboration with Other News. It's an international service that provides reporting and analysis in English, Spanish, and Italian. Three presidents in 1 week, massive protests led by the youth. What's going on in Peru? Joining us now to make sense of this is Patricia Oliot. She's a senior lecturer in Latin American Studies and head of Spanish, Portuguese, and Latin American Studies at Newcastle University in the United Kingdom. Thanks for joining us, Patricia.
Thanks you for having me.
So it wasn't that many years ago that Peru had apparently supposedly done this big turnaround. It was going to be one of the great stars of Latin America economically. Democracy had returned. And now, you know, at least at the level of presidential politics, it's kind of like a basket case. Corruption is rampant. Presidents are falling left and right. So give us some of the historical context, and then we'll get into what's happening now.
Okay. It depends on how back in history you want to go.
Well, a lot of people, the last thing they kind of know is Fujimori. So
yes, the problems for the situation now start a bit before that. In 1985, there is substantial research showing that with the first government of Alan Garcia, there was a sort of a seize of the state by the mafias in Peru, particularly narcotráfico and a lot of what we call the submerged economy. So illegal mining, illegal logging, narcotráfico, cocaine production and commercialization, linked also to the collapse of the cartels in Colombia. And it's more or less the same people in charge of these submerged economies that with Alan Garcia have access to power, together with neoliberal reforms that also allow a lot of influence for the formal economy in the state.
So by neoliberal reforms, you mean privatization?
And the shrinking of the state, flexibilization of a lot of laws for trade, etc.
To what extent do the Americans have anything to do with all this?
I think more or less at that moment, we are beginning a different global world. And certainly the U.S. have an influence, but there are other interests coming into the country, and also a very strong interest in oil exploration and exploitation, and also mining. And so at that moment in the late 80s and 90s, it's the world of the corporations more than specific countries. And you can see that happening in the country. So Alan Garcia finished his regime in 1990 and then started Fujimori. And these were 10 years of demolishing of the state from within. And also by the growth of all these submerged economies in the different regions with certain groups gaining more influence and power. There is also a process of capturing of the judiciary in the country. So the laws don't really work.
Captured by who? The narcos or the corporates or both?
Both. It's an alliance. It's a tacit alliance. So the formal sectors of the economy turning a blind eye on the other side, and the others just creeping into every single corner they could control.
Just one question about the narco gangs from Colombia. Is there like cocaine in Peru, or they're bringing their money from Colombia to establish themselves in Peru?
Peru, I think, is among the three main producers of coca leaves in the region. So you find coca plantations in Bolivia, Peru, and Colombia. These are the three countries where the coca plant grows. And there has been a 400% growth in coca plantations in Peru in the past 30 years. And there is a new variety of the plant that can now grow in the lower areas in the Amazon that it was not the case before. It used to grow mostly on the east slopes of the Andes, facing the Amazon. So mountains and heat and humidity. But now it is growing in lower areas and in the forest as well, in the rainforest as well. So there has been an expansion of the areas for the coca plantations. And a very rapid process of, we could call it democratization in the production of cocaine. It is not produced in labs anymore. The very growers of the plant can produce the basic paste, or pasta básica, prior to cocaine, and then process it very quickly into kilos. And so there is now a huge network of mostly young people distributing these kilos of cocaine to the places where the cocaine leaves the country, from the coast in the Pacific or through Bolivia and Brazil through the Atlantic.
And I assume a lot of it's going to the United States.
Yes, the map has changed a lot. In the 80s, most of the market was controlled by Colombians. So the drug produced in Peru would go to Colombia and from Colombia to the world. But with the war on drugs in Colombia, the narcotraficantes lose power in Colombia. Mexico takes control, the cartels in Mexico take control of the distribution of cocaine from South America to the US. And the production of cocaine is widespread all over the region by small producers who are at the same time the people who, in many cases, also grow the plant.
So the state that emerges in the late 90s is this sort of alliance, or I would guess even merging in many places, narco money and corporate money, a lot to do with resource extraction money. So it's either cocaine resource extraction or mining. And they're all together in building the state. Okay.
Yes, that's more or less the scenario. And right, in parallel with this, you have basically the disappearance of the political system that existed before the 80s. The electoral laws facilitate access to power from all these little lords of the formal and informal economy in the country, becoming themselves candidates. And so we have at the moment, I think, 12 candidates for the presidency in the country.
This is in the coming elections in April, right?
Yes.
Yeah, what is it like? Half of them are under indictment for corruption or one thing or the other.
Exactly. In Congress right now, 68 out of 130 are processed. Some of them even sentenced for.
I mean, charged.
Charged, yes. So all of them in a wide range of crimes, no?
Well, I don't want to break your historical argument narrative, but get to the point. No rush, but how do you even get a judiciary that's willing to charge these people? I mean, like, it's like almost the whole government is involved in this kind of corruption.
Exactly. Well, the thing is that there is a very healthy core of civil servants in the country, in spite of all of these. No, there are prosecutors who are trying really hard, and it is very volatile. It all depends on the support they have from the president, the alliances they form among themselves to build the cases and push them further. It's a struggle within the state that is quite dramatic. So the moment we are in is, in a way, the result of this healthy core of civil servants, independent journalism, and young people.
Okay, we'll get back to the present. So, pick up the narrative. We enter the 2000s with a corporate narco state.
Exactly, it is. We don't dare yet to call it like that, but more and more people are showing evidence of this, no? So we have the end of Fujimori.
Talk about Fujimori for a bit here, because that's the point that a lot of people know about.
Fujimori was in power from 1990 to 2000.
But this corporate narco state evolves under Fujimori.
Absolutely. His advisor, his main advisor, Vladimiro Montesinos, now in jail, was kind of the organizer of this corrupt state. There is a famous interview with one of the latest presidents in Colombia, mentioning how they discovered that Vladimiro Montesinos, this close advisor of Fujimori, was dealing with arms, delivering arms to the FARC in Colombia, because he didn't stop short of getting involved in anything that was profitable. So at one point during the Fujimori regime, Lima was the place where people from Al Qaeda would come to get sets of passports for the world. No, so falsification of documents and narcotráfico, arms dealings, you name it.
I mean, that's my memory of Fujimori, the way the West was portraying him. He was this economic reformer. He was going to make the economy efficient. I mean, I don't remember much of this being talked about at all.
No, the narrative was that his regime brought Peru to the global financial system. At that moment, we had missions from the Inter-American Development Bank, the World Bank, implementing the reform of the state. And he went along with this very happily. And it was incredible, because he used the money coming for the transformation of the state to gain popularity. So it was money coming from abroad to push for the transformation of the Peruvian state, but he used this money for partisan purposes. And so he became very popular. The state finally, because of these reforms, appeared in many places in the shape of schools, medical attention, a very interesting reform in the judiciary as well, that decentralized the implementation of justice. So for a lot of people, the Fujimori regime is the moment when the state finally reaches the most remote corners of the country. And at the same time, due to the liberalization of the economy, we get a lot of foreign investment, because he relaxed a lot the laws for giving concessions for exploration and exploitation of fossil fuels, and also for mining. So it is a moment where there is a lot of investment in the country, and a very clear turn to being a country that exports primary resources.
But under this veneer is rampant corruption.
Exactly. From 2000, from the year 2000, because of a constitution that was signed during the Fujimori regime in 1993, The political system was very severely affected because all the big political parties disappeared due to the lack of political freedom that there were in those years. Some people call these years the era of anti-politics in the country because they were not relevant at all, because we lived within a regime that was almost a dictatorship. So there was not really a space for any kind of political negotiation. There was a very silent dismantling of all the unions, for example, along with the internal conflict with the Shining Path. So it was on one hand state repression, and on the other, the guerrilla attack on the very thick network of social grassroots organizations that we had before the 1990s. So it was a moment of disarticulation of the country, the social fabric of the country.
So talk a little bit what Shining Path was, because I know most people, including myself, have the vaguest notion of it being described as this terrorist group and all of that.
Yes, they were very they were Maoist, very similar to the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, in their ideas.
Oh, really? The Khmer Rouge, really? They were rather fanatical.
It's very similar. It's very similar in their ideas, in their demeanor as well, and in the way in which they treated the communities that they managed to capture. They came from the 1965 Sino-Soviet split. They were a small fraction of this communist fraction that happened in those years. And they had a leader that was a provincial intellectual that nurtured the rage that people with frustrated expectations had in the country. Peru went through a process of rapid social mobility for disenfranchised groups in the 1960s and 70s. But Peru is also a very racist country with no opportunities for social mobility if you are of indigenous origin. So the Shining Path really fed into this frustration. It grew rapidly in teaching schools, for example, and teacher training schools. A typical sector coming from peasants, working classes that have access to higher education and then are doomed to have these low-paid jobs that in Peru a teacher earns very little money. Is the worst paid sector in Latin America. If you compare school teachers all over the region, Peruvian teachers are at the bottom. So that's where he grew. He had a very loyal and firm militancy. And they decided that it was a moment to engage in a war, in a popular war. And they declared the war to the state in 1979 and started attacking the state from its weakest point. So the school teacher could be the enemy and they would kill the teacher, mayors, union leaders, grassroots leaders who were not with them. So their idea was with us or against us.
And let me ask a question. Was Shining Path manipulated at all by this? I know, I just remember Fujimori used Shining Path as the rationale for what amounted to dictatorship. If he hadn't had Shining Path, I don't know how he would have exercised such power. Does Shining Path, was it really its own thing, or did the state actually in any way help create the thing?
What they did was to delay their defeat. They were smaller than the government portrayed them, but they this is a narrative that comes from the secret police trying to finish the Shining Path. And there are books and testimonies of how there were opportunities where they could have finished with the organization. And it was Fujimori who delayed his capture, so much so that they took advantage of a moment when Fujimori was on vacation fishing to actually capture the leader of the Shining Path and presented the fait accompli to him, and he had to acknowledge and sit on top of it as his own victory. But they had to capture Abimael Guzman without Fujimori knowing. And it was a very small group in the police who performed this achievement for the country. Yeah.
So how does Fujimori come to an end?
Because of his corruption. There was a lot of protests from 1997. He won the elections in 2000, but it was clearly rigged. There were lots of evidences of these, but still he was the president when he left the country in November in 2000. And he left because someone leaked videos that his advisor had been accumulating in a very incredibly well-staged scenario where he had a camera filming everybody who had some power in society and him taking loads of money, actual cash, and negotiating with him. Okay, 10,000 is okay. Okay, here you go. No, and you had their newspaper owners, media officials, authorities, congressmen, people from other political parties, military men, etc. He even filmed a ceremony where he had several officers in the military and the police signing allegiance to the regime, and he filmed it.
Now, the Americans liked Fujimori, right? The American state. And they must have known how corrupt he was.
I'm not sure. I think there were mixed reports from the U.S. embassy to the U.S., because it was clear that he wasn't democratic. And so I think it depended on who was reporting what, because there were clear human rights abuses, for example, and there were people from Washington coming to assess those situations, because it acted as an occupation army in the highlands, and there were several war crimes, really, against peasant communities. So it depends on who in the U.S., no? But it was certainly probably economically interesting because the investments were high and it was really easy to get a hold of territories with rich resources in mining and oil.
But also Fujimori was seen as a figure who was very much against the left, against socialism. In fact, they even tried to equate Shining Path with some of the kind of socialist movements in other parts of Latin America. And I think the Americans liked him for that.
Yes, he did that indeed. And he was very successful in inserting in people a deep distrust from anything progressive. So for a few years, it was very difficult from anyone with progressive ideas to further their ideas or advance politically until the last past decade, probably. It is something that in these days, it's really nice to observe the struggle to reinstate the validity of some progressive ideas in this context.
Okay, so Fujimori goes down, the corruption's his corruption becomes clear. So, and what comes next?
So when these videos are leaked and everybody can see on television what happened, he escapes to Japan and resigns with a fax saying that he's no longer the president. And after his resignation, there were elections in Peru. And then we have a series of presidents that kept more or less the same economic model, kept the economic growth and the same constitution that favors foreign investors and lowers environmental standards, and also doesn't allow for the creation of unions, and there is a progressive loss of workers' rights. No, so the package, the whole package continued throughout the years. It's so interesting because every election that we had since 2000, in 2006, 2011, 2016, the candidate winning the election was the candidate opposite to the Fujimori party. No. But in the end, the economic program was the same. Even in 2011, we had an openly left-wing candidate who promised the great transformation and had a very anti-neoliberal electoral platform. But once he was in power, he dropped everything and said that he wasn't going to conduct the transformation, but a map. He was going to follow a map to take us to a better place. But he increased the repression and also concessions to mining companies, etc. So it was more of the same.
And the narco gangs still have the same kind of power?
Yes. With the fragmentation of the political system, what you have now, similar to what happens in Mexico, is that if before the narcotraficantes or the submerged economy, because it's very complex, it's not just cocaine, it's illegal mining, mostly for gold, and also other minerals that are extracted under terrible conditions all over the country, and illegal timber as well. In the different regions, instead of them paying political parties to pass laws that favored them, what happened is that they themselves became candidates. In the regions, these people have a lot of power. They build sports stadiums. They give money for schools. They develop cheap housing. So they throw their money out to their regions. And then they have started capturing Congress to pass laws that favor them in very specific aspects of the running of the regions where they are, to favor their economic activities. So the Congress is like a market of very small interests where congressmen and women negotiate their interests to have the right correlation of voting for whatever law they want to pass. So it is a total mess.
I don't think that's so different than what goes on in Washington, but go on.
In 2016, we had a candidate who is right-wing, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski. He's worked in the U.S. He's been an executive or in sitting in the directories of all companies, etc. So he was clearly pro-neoliberal president, but he faced Fujimori's daughter in those elections. And they were in the final run for the elections, just Keiko Fujimori and Kuczynski. And he got the support of the majority of the population because people were saying Fujimori never again. So Kuczynski got to the government, and there were at the moment, do you know of the Odebrecht scandal from Brazil?
What year are we in?
We are in 2016 now.
Okay.
So 2018. So I think Kuczynski was 2 years in power, and then came the president who was vacated, as we say, 10 days ago. So what happened was that Kuczynski won, and when he was president, something very interesting happened in the judiciary, and is that an independent group of prosecutors started better than in any other country in Latin America, having a lot of success following the implications of the Odebrecht scandal in Peru. Odebrecht is a company in Brazil who had been achieving concessions to carry out public works in construction, in roads and dams and all these big infrastructure projects all over Latin America with a scheme, with a very perverse mechanism. They had a double accountancy, one for the projects they won, and the other one that was there to bribe governments to accept their projects when they came on. How do you call this when several candidates present a project and the government has to choose for the provider? There is, well, concessiones, we call it. When. So they had a system by which they would pay lawyers, officers to gain the concessions to their projects, sometimes pricing them at a very low budgets and high technological standards, so that once they got the contract for the project, they would insert addendums to the project to get more money, and in exchange they would give expensive presents to the officials involved, etc. So everybody was mirrored with this scheme all over Latin America. In Colombia, people trying to do research on these issues have been killed. In other countries, the whole investigation has been muffled, but not in Peru. And in Peru, the president, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, was linked to these schemes, and he resigned.
And this is 10 days ago.
No, this was 2018, right? So he resigned, and then the Peruvian ambassador in Canada, Martin Vizcarra, became president because he was the vice president in Kuczynski's list. So Vizcarra is an engineer from south of Peru, from Moquegua, a good guy, and an engineer wanting to serve the country. And so he came to Peru, became president, but he was completely alone. And he was not linked to any group in power, not in the formal economy or the informal economy. And he had not even a progressive discourse, but a very decent one. So he wanted to fight corruption. He wanted to expand state services. He wanted to broaden the fiscal program, you know, reasonable things. He was immediately seen by the most conservative sectors in society as an enemy, as well as from all of the corruption groups. And the opposition to him in Congress and in the media, the official media, was relentless, very, very heavy. And so 10 days ago, what happened was that Congress voted to discard him as president because five people emerged to testify that he had also been corrupted by Odebrecht from Brazil when he was governor south of Peru in Moquegua, because he had accepted the equivalent probably of $600,000 more or less on bribes to conduct projects. He has denied everything. He has surrendered his accounts, his passport, everything to be investigated. That's when Congress said that he couldn't be the president with these allegations. He's not even been charged. There is not even a complete case against him. It's an investigation, an ongoing investigation. And so they did this to him twice. So the first time he went with his lawyer to Congress to defend himself, and he stayed, he remained. But 2 months after, when these five people emerge and start giving the similar testimony about him being corrupt as well, they decided to get him out of power, and he didn't do anything. He said he was tired, and he said the investigation is going, and I'm not doing anything. So he didn't contest the second attempt. And that's where we didn't have a president. And then the Congress elected a guy who has very good relationships with all the little corrupt organizations currently in Congress. No? And he negotiated with each of them interests for passing laws that the executive had been rejecting because they were not viable, because they were damaging for the state. If can I tell you what the kind of businesses are? with one of the ministers of education is currently the head of the World Bank Division on Education, Jaime Saavedra. So he's a World Bank specialist in education. And we had him as Minister of Education in Peru for the past two regimes. He was Minister of Education with Humala, the left-wing guy who turned out neoliberal, and with Kuczynski. And from the Ministry of Education, he wanted to formalize education and clean the education market from corruption. Because there are fake universities in Peru. There are fake private schools in Peru that provide really poor services. And there was no system of accreditation. So these two consecutive regimes tried to create a system of accreditation to preserve the right to a proper education to the students attending these places. So they created a commission to initiate processes of accreditation for education institutions. And this affected the mafias controlling these really poor education businesses, no? Universities for profit with no really credentials at all. So some of them were closed. And some of the members of Congress that voted to get rid of Vizcarra are owners of these universities, for example. There you have one. Then, because of the Odebrecht investigations, there are many business people who have also been linked to contracting services with this company, and also for passing bribes to regional, local municipalities, etc., to gain access to these infrastructure projects. So they are trying to stop the investigations for these allegations, and in some cases, very well-formed cases.
So 10 days ago, the president resigns, the Congress elects a new one. What happens to him?
What happened was that as soon as he was elected, people went out to the streets because the rage that there is in the country of having these mafias in power is enormous. This is why we have been voting every time for whoever we saw as non-representing the mafias. So whoever had an agenda of fighting corruption, we voted for. No, regardless even of the program they presented, whoever said stop corruption, this is it, and I am going after this and that, then we voted for this person because the rest is quite poor and empty, and you can see the little corrupted people participating in the elections with sometimes plagiarized government programs. So it's really miserable. So when these people won and got rid of the president, people went to the streets. And in the protests, two young men died, also because the police were in the streets to kill. there are videos of policemen saying, kill him, you know, that kind of thing, and shooting to the body. No, so it was not just tear gas, but there were also pellets,
rubber bullets.
Rubber bullets, but they are 80% lead.
Well, that ain't rubber,
right? The coating is rubber, but 80% of the pellet is lead.
And two students were killed.
Yes, once they die, people are in the streets in the largest ever seen protest movement in the country. No, in Lima, for example, you would see 50,000 people in one plaza and some other people marching in the streets in previous years. This time, last Sunday, you had similar amounts of people in different districts in Lima, in the smallest towns in Peru. The whole country was out. Well, there was a survey that says that 13% of the population was in the streets, no? Not counting people banging pots from their houses because of the pandemic, or hanging banners in their houses, or people under 18 who were a large proportion of the people attending these marches because of the situation of precarization that corruption has contributed to in the country together with neoliberalism. So if you want, in Peru, the struggle against neoliberalism is linked to the fight against corruption.
And most of the people in the streets were young, is that right?
They were very salient. And what I think makes them visible is that because of the protest culture that has developed globally, they took control of the shape of the manifestation and its endurance. They gave it stamina and a lot of energy. But you had people in wheelchairs in the streets. You had, it was a massive multi-generational manifestation of discontent.
And social media played a big role.
Social media played a crucial role because we don't have political parties, we don't have unions. So the communities, gamers, skaters, TikTokers, K-popers, no, were articulating the protest, giving people ideas of where to gather, giving geo-referenced locations of where the police were, organizing brigades to advance in the streets with, with the Hong Kong techniques of using shields and laser beams to confuse the police. Everything you can imagine, learned from the Chilean upheaval from last year, from Hong Kong, making crash the media, hacking web pages from Congress, for example. The Congress page was hacked. So all this protest culture that is global was used massively in this protest and made it very, very effective.
So then this next president has to resign under the pressure of these protests.
Exactly.
And so where are we now? Who's president and what's next here?
In Congress, when they decided to get rid of Vizcarra, the votes were 105 out of 130. 105 voted for ousting Vizcarra, and 19 voted for him to remain. No? And so it is a sort of tradition that if something like this happened, because it happened exactly 20 years ago, the president can't be from the president that had been rejected by the population. So none of the 105 could be the next president. So the next president needed to come from the 19 who voted against the elimination of Vizcarra. And so that's how we have a very interesting group of people. We have Francisco Sagasti as our president now. He is an engineer, philosopher, expert in scientific and technological development. He served in the World Bank, in different branches of government in Peru, mostly linked to science and technology. And he is a very well-mannered man. He knows how to establish dialogue. And so he was accepted by most of the Congress for the governability of the country, so a governmentality of the country. So we have him in power now. The president of Congress is a lawyer and an activist of peasants' rights, confronting mining companies. She has won twice Buenaventura Mining Company to defend people who are resisting selling their land to big mining projects, and she's a human rights activist, and from the left. So she's the president of Congress now, and that's where we are.
And that's where we are.
Yes.
And are the youth and others, people still in the streets, or people are not? Protests continue?
Yes, protests continue for two reasons. One is that people want a clear investigation about the particularities of the presence of the police during these last 10 days, because we have never seen anything that violent. For a few days, there were around 50 people disappeared. They were kidnapped by the police, imprisoned with no formal charging, with no prosecutor present, and tortured as well. No, and so for had it not been for human rights organizations that really canvassed the whole city looking for them, they would probably be dead now or still disappeared. There are no disappeared at the moment, but and it is due to the pressure from civil society and human rights organizations. But there is no clear decision yet from the new government about how to deal with this, and how to establish criminal responsibilities for people who acted in this way. And at the moment, they are all avoiding responsibilities. And so people are in the streets because they want clarity, people held responsible, and also compensation for the families of not just the two kids who were killed, but also of 102 severely wounded people with bullets in the head, paralyzed, with bullets in the back, it's terrible. So the damage has been terrible. The new president has visited some of these wounded people in hospitals, but there's still nothing clear about who is going to take responsibility of this.
And this is all happening during the COVID pandemic. And if I understand correctly, Peru has maybe the second highest per capita mortality rate in the world. Because I guess in the midst of all this chaos, how can there be any real control over the pandemic?
Exactly. Well, one of the terrible things that happened from the start, and that is also linked to corruption, was that we didn't really have a proper health system. Formally, we have universal coverage. But if you are ill and go to a public hospital, you need to take a relative to take care of you because there are no nurses, your own bedding, and buy medicines wherever you can because hospitals are really poor. So we have the system, we have the doctors, but nothing else.
I saw the same thing in Afghanistan in 2002. We found a kid whose head had been split open, and he needed stitches, but we had to run down the street to buy sutures to do the stitching because they didn't have anything to stitch with.
Exactly. So Vizcarra, the former president 10 days ago, knew this, and this is why Peru had one of the quickest reactions to the pandemic, and with very hard measures of confinement, etc., because the system was not going to be able to respond. No, and yet, In that circumstance, we still saw corruption within the state. A person working in a public hospital who had just received medicines to treat COVID stole the medicines to take them to her own pharmacy. No, so that kind of thing. Or a relative of the governor in Iquitos who had received from the airport oxygen to treat patients kidnapped these oxygen tanks in order to sell them privately. No? So corruption is absolutely generalized, and this has also hindered the intentions of the government to respond to it.
So out of this protest movement, is there a progressive political formation that could emerge as an alternative?
Well, what is interesting is I told you about the first reason why people are in the streets. And the second reason why people are in the streets now is because it is growing the understanding that at the root of all the evil things happening to Peruvians is the constitution of Fujimori of 1993. Because this constitution creates a political party system that allows for this fragmentation and the election of corrupt people because of the system, the voting system, that basically you vote for individuals and not for political parties when you vote for Congress. And then the other thing is the little power the state has at the moment due to this constitution to stop monopolies or, you know, one enterprise grabbing. For example, there is one company that owns 80% of pharmacies in the country. And the government can't do anything about that because of the constitution. No, so at the root of several of our evils, people see the need for changing constitution. And we just have what happened in Chile, where this change of constitution was at the root of the movement, no, of the upheaval. And so this idea is growing. And the other thing that is happening is that people are starting to understand that being left-wing or progressive doesn't make you a terrorist, which is the idea that Fujimori instilled very deep in people's fears, no? Because the experience of the armed conflict was traumatic for many people. And everybody saw these as linked to socialist ideas, etc. So something that is interesting in these days is that these, we could say, anti-progressive ideas are losing prestige, no, at the moment, and people don't believe these anymore. People are being more critical these days of fake news and all these right-wing, very conservative ideas that demonize anyone who talks of progressive changes, etc. So something nice may happen out of this. We have elections in April next year. Some people are saying that could be the moment to work towards a change in the constitution. But we still have people in the streets because of the human rights issue, and also because there is a growing demand for changing the 1993 constitution. So we don't know what is going to happen, and it is not clear yet how the president is going to tackle the opposition or the voice from the streets. No, he started his first addressing to the nation, acknowledging the importance of the political participation of people in the streets. He acknowledged the dead kids. He apologized from the state to the nation for these events, but it is not clear yet what he's going to do about that. Either the constitution, he has not said a word about it. What he's saying is that his main commitment is in the 5 or 8 in the months that he has towards April, he wants to have clear, transparent elections, and he wants to fight COVID. So those two are his priorities. That's what he wants to do. And it's very interesting because he had called for a cabinet, a really interesting range of people with trajectory in the state, as several of them either have served as ministers in previous regimes or have been vice ministers. And so it's a very competent team, seen by the right wing as left wing, socialist, communist, Chavistas, whatever. But they are all really interesting professionals, and many of them with no qualms about neoliberal economic plans or whatever. But
what do you mean by no qualms? You mean no qualms about being neoliberal or being anti-neoliberal?
Being neoliberal.
So it's a very centrist group.
Exactly. It's a center cabinet.
But I suppose if they're not rabidly corrupt, that's some move in the right direction.
I think that's the major gain of this whole thing.
Well, I saw that Peru's gross GDP has gone down by 14% since the pandemic quit. So high mortality rate, high unemployment, and the economy, the way that this is going, is going to get worse. Listen, we'll come back to you, Patricia. We'll in a few weeks we come back and we'll talk again and catch up where things are.
Okay. Well, thank you.
And thank you so much for doing this. And thank you for joining us on the analysis.news podcast. Please don't forget, we've got this fundraising campaign going on. We have a $10,000 matching grant. If you give a buck, we'll get it matched a buck. If you donate monthly, that will get matched. And thanks for joining us on the analysis.news.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.